We're back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Daniela Guzman-Pena, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is the Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy. Hi, everyone. It's Daniela from the Tech Policy Grind. We took a short hiatus from the podcast, but we're back. I know you've been sitting on the edge of your seat waiting for a new episode to drop, and it's finally here. This week, we're sharing two conversations that have one thing at their core: ethics. First, we chatted with Aishwarya Vardhana about her role as a product designer at Wikipedia. As a full-stack product designer, she designs innovative interfaces and experiences with safety, privacy, and other human rights considerations baked into the product. At State of the Net, when this conversation was recorded, she shared how she thinks about building an ethical, inclusive, and responsible technology, and how she prioritizes user needs to help keep people safe online. Then we sat down with Harley Geiger, Counsel on Cybersecurity Services at Venable, about ethical red teaming. What is ethical red teaming? And how are red teamers protected under the law when they test out vulnerabilities of AI models? We get into that and much more in the conversation with Harley and Foundry fellow Sasha Jovanovich and me during the State of the Net. First, here's Aishwarya Vardhana, product designer at Wikipedia, on the role of ethical product design for trust and safety.
Aishwarya, thanks for being here. Could you start off by telling us a little bit about what you do at the Wikimedia Foundation and what your role is as a product designer for trust and safety?
Definitely. And before I do that, I also want to share that the Wikimedia Foundation owns Wikipedia and 13 other 3D knowledge projects. So I'm Aishwarya. I'm a senior UX designer at the foundation. So I'm on the moderator tools team. So my product team builds tools for our moderators. So these are Wikipedia volunteers who patrol articles for things like vandalism. And then they do what we call reverting articles so that vandalism is removed. And so moderators are doing this type of really important work. But vandalism is an increasing problem on Wikipedia. And so we want to make sure that they have the best possible tech to combat these issues. So my team thinks about what do our moderators need to do their work. How can we prevent burnout? How can we increase their impact? How can we free up their time so that they can do the tasks that they want to do? Maybe some of the more complex thinking, less of the, you know, kind of repetitive, redundant work. We build tools for them. And so as a UX designer, design at the foundation is, we practice a community-centered design, which means we keep the needs of the community at the heart of our design process. And as the designer, I steward the product process from concept all the way to implementation. So we think about what is the user need, you know, what is the human problem that we're trying to solve, and then we'll do research on understanding that problem space better. We'll look at other products and other tools and take inspiration, taking patterns of successful products and tools, and then we'll start prototyping and iterating, and we share our designs with our community volunteers. We publish all of the work that we do. We track everything in an open source task management system so that our volunteers can see, you know, this is the design direction that we're going, what do they think. Designers at the foundation really like to host community conversations where we'll, you know, have a call and we'll try to understand how a certain wiki, let's say like Spanish Wikipedia volunteers, how do they feel about this product that we're thinking about? What are the real challenges that they face? What are the real opportunities that were there? And then we'll work with them to then design this end-to-end user experience. Finally, there's, you know, testing, there's working with engineers to make sure designs are implemented implement it to perfection, basically. Whatever you design, you want to make sure it's shipped as it was designed and as it can be. And then once it's out there, then it's a process of collecting the data, getting that feedback, and then updating design. So product designers, we do this end-to-end product process.
So I think it's really interesting that Wiccan Media Foundation takes on a human-centered participatory design process for its product design.
Yes.
Usually private platforms sort of operate in a centralized manner, but this seems like a really democratic process of building. What do you think is the importance of including users in the design process and having that participatory framework?
Yes. Well, the definition of user experience design, at least the way I understand it, is meeting unmet human needs. So without the user, you don't really have a clear objective of what you're trying to do. So the user, the human, like what they need or what their problems are, is at the heart of good product design. This is my opinion. So we collaborate very closely. Mostly our stakeholders are the Wikimedia open source community. So these are the almost 265,000 volunteers around the world. So we collaborate with them very closely, and then we have the Wikipedia readers. So folks like you and me who go visit Wikipedia and read articles, so we collaborate closely with them. And then also with our colleagues. So the Wikimedia Foundation is a very collaborative organization as well. We try to embody the spirit of Wikipedia. So all of this close collaboration is done in an open way. Like I said, we publish our designs, we share our work openly. The machine learning models that we use are open source. So in this way, we invite our volunteers into the process so that their ideas are heard, their concerns are heard, and we're sailing a ship, and we're kind of sailing it together. So if they think we should go in a slightly different direction, it'll be a conversation. And it's, I would say it's a much slower process since there's so many voices at the table, but like you said, it's a democratic process, and the process is what makes Wikimedia so trustworthy and so reliable. And that's a bit about how the participatory design works. One thing I will say, so as a designer, I really do think my designs thrive on collaboration, because the more people that have kind of scrutinized it, given feedback, each iteration, it just gets better.
Thanks so much for explaining that. When you're working on a trust and safety product deliverable, I think some of the trade-offs with having a multi-stakeholder approach or using a participatory design framework is, like you said, a longer process when you're taking into consideration all of these multi-stakeholder interests. And how do you balance the trade-off of speed and delivering a product with participatory design and really intentional design that's focused on user safety and taking into account all of these different global and cultural nuances?
Like I was saying, our entire model is different from a for-profit company. So for us, a product isn't successful if our volunteer community hasn't bought into that product, into that tool. So we need community buy-in for our products to be successful. That's kind of baked into how we operate. So it really isn't so much about the tension, right, between moving fast versus being collaborative. Being collaborative is why we do what we do, so I think that helps for us and for our unique model. That being said, it is, in comparison, a slower product process, and we kind of balance that. So one of the things that I've heard is go slow to go fast. So what this means is we've developed some really great resources that we use. One of these resources, so a few of us got together at the foundation and developed what we call Inclusive Chronicle Development Playbook. And this playbook is, like it's a playbook, and it's a resource to develop tech in a thoughtful, intentional, accountable, and inclusive way. So my team, Moderator Tools, is using this playbook to design Auto Moderator, which is the project that I'm here to talk about. We've been using it to redesign this AI tool in an inclusive and equitable way. So these resources help us go faster because they have standardized the best practice to be inclusive, to be equitable. And so there's that, and then honestly, it's at the planning stage. So when you're creating a roadmap for your product, or let's say it's a policy or whatever, a project, you're at the planning stage, you're accounted for how you're going to use participatory processes, then it's already, it's already in the book. So shift from that. So I think it's also good to include it.
Yeah, thank you. So kind of taking that participatory design process as part of the holistic playbook for product design is how you make sure you set expectations with other cross-functional stakeholders and make sure that it's not a blocker, it's not seen as a blocker, but it's actually something that is providing more value to your teams. Could you talk a little bit about the tool that you and your team have been developing to support content moderators in the community?
Yes. So the tool is an AI tool. It's an AI-powered tool called Auto Moderator. And it will enable our company members to detect and remove vandalism. So just to tell you a little story, right? Let's say you wake up and you're like, I want to understand what the history of AI is. I want to use service level description. So like a lot of people do, you might pull AI and you might go to Wikipedia and just start skimming the Wikipedia article on the history of AI. So if you go behind the scenes of that role, you'll see what we call its revision history, which is every edit that's ever been made to that role. You can see who made it, when it was made, what it was. And sometimes edits to these articles are what we call obvious vandalism. So this is, it'll be very obvious, and it has no place in that article. And so our Wikipedia volunteers will detect that vandalism, and they'll remove it. And so this AI tool that we're building will help them screen every single edit, and it'll determine, is this vandalism, is this not? It'll give it a determination. And based on how the volunteers configure this tool, it'll remove the vandalism, or it'll say, oh, maybe it's not. So this tool is kind of when our hope, at least, is that it alleviates some of that work. It's okay to do.
So it's really a partnership between this AI technology and the human review that's already happening with these community moderators.
Yes, 100%. So I think it's important to note that the Wikipedia volunteers have been using AI tools in bots since 2002. So what we're doing, so Auto Moderator is not the first AI tool that they've used. But since 2002 until now, we've always ensured that there is a human review.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your work, Aishwarya. It was wonderful to speak to you, and I hope that we can bring you on to another episode of the Tech Policy Grind to talk more about your work in product design and trust and safety.
Let's do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since this episode is focused on responsible design, we also wanted to share this conversation from State of the Net with Harley Geiger, Counsel on Cybersecurity at Venable, as he discusses the legal protections and gaps for ethical AI red team units. He discusses why it's important for non-security vulnerabilities like bias and discrimination to be considered as valid reasons for testing these systems. Here's Harley.
Hi, Harley.
Hello.
How's it going?
Things are going really well. Thank you. How are you doing?
Great. So I just sat in on your lightning talk, and I wanted to maybe dig into some of these issues related to AI, ethical hacking, and red teaming. For people who don't really understand what ethical red teaming or ethical hacking means, could you give sort of a layman's definition of that when it pertains to AI?
So I would say that ethical red teaming or ethical hacking is when an individual or an organization is hacking a computer or information system in order to find vulnerabilities or flaws for the purpose of disclosing that to the owner of that system, so that the system can, owner can then correct them before a criminal or malicious actor can exploit them. So the whole purpose really is one of intent. There are some practical differences, like you're not going to cause damage or exfiltrate too much data, but the main difference is that you're doing it for the purpose of strengthening security, not to cause harm or to make money like through extortion. You can do this, and in fact, this occurs for software of any type, critical infrastructure, internet software, and of course, artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence has security concerns, and people can, for example, work through a bug bounty platform to find security vulnerabilities, disclose it to the owner of the AI system, and then receive a reward, or just disclose it to them so that they can fix it. But the interesting thing about artificial intelligence is that artificial intelligence also has a lot of non-security concerns related to things like bias, discrimination, toxic content, abusive content, things like that. And we are starting to see standards, guidelines, methodologies being put into place to test AI systems for those non-security issues, right? So things like bug bounties have been around for a long time. And we're also seeing things like bias bounties, where individuals are testing AI, finding ways that the AI system produces bias or toxic or harmful content, disclosing that to the AI system owner in order to strengthen the trustworthiness of AI.
Thanks so much. And your talk is really about pointing out that there are legal protections for ethical hackers when they're working on sort of exposing security vulnerabilities. But when it comes to these non-security flaws or vulnerabilities that have to do with bias, discrimination, harmful content, toxic content, etc., those protections may not exist or they may not be applied. So what do you think are some of the gaps that exist right now in legal protections that maybe should be applied to these trust and safety teams that are working on ethical and sort of red teaming for AI technologies?
So it's, in general, if you have the, if you're an internal red team unit, then in your red teaming your own AI system, in general, you're already protected because you're doing it with internal authorization. Where some of the gaps occur is for things like information sharing and for independent AI hacking. And I'll explain what I mean. So the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act of 2015, we call it CISA 2015, established a lot of protections for organizations sharing information about security. And so that included things like vulnerabilities, exploits, attack vectors, cyber threat information. So if groups of companies wanted to get together and they share this kind of information, then they have liability protection from things like antitrust or certain privacy laws, etc. However, that law on information sharing protection really just applies to security. It just applies to security considerations. So if you are sharing information about non-security issues for AI, things like bias, discrimination, or let's say synthetic child sexual abuse material, then that same, those same liability protections don't necessarily apply because those are not strictly security issues. Now, so that's one bucket, is information sharing. That's an important one, I think, for particularly for large companies. The second bucket that I would say is for the independent red hacking, or independent red teaming that I mentioned. So under our current laws, if I were to have, let's say, an IoT device, and I wanted to find vulnerabilities within that IoT device, and then disclose it to the manufacturer so that they could fix it, years and years ago, that would have technically been illegal under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201. Potentially, depending on what servers you're touching, it could also be illegal under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Fast forward to today, we have recognized that that kind of activity is beneficial to the ecosystem, it's beneficial to the product manufacturer, because it strengthens security of products for manufacturers to know about vulnerabilities. And so we have built in legal protections for that type of activity when it's done independently. So Section 1201 of the DMCA, I know it's a mouthful, but that's one of our main anti-hacking laws. It does have a specific protection for security testing, independent security testing. But again, that's security testing, not testing for something like bias, discrimination, or these other non-security harms that we recognize are important to AI deployment. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Department of Justice issued a charging policy modeled actually on that 1201 protection, saying that prosecutors should decline to prosecute individuals that are doing independent, good-faith security research. But once again, this is the theme, cover security, not non-security issues. And so those are a few of the gaps. Some of the ways that I think companies can approach this is by starting to accept disclosures from individuals on these non-security issues. Companies and federal government agencies are increasingly becoming used to having coordinated vulnerability disclosure policies, which is basically just a channel for accepting security vulnerability information from the outside world. But because those cover security, they may not cover things like AI bias and non-security issues. So moving toward a place where companies are more willing or prepared to accept disclosures about bias and non-security issues with their AI deployments, I think will help them build processes to fix these issues before they become a bigger problem and potentially harm individuals.
I'm curious also about standards around AI red teaming. I know that there's a lot of work being done in different agencies across the US government, and then there is also the big AI red teaming attempt at DEF CON last year. So, what, in your opinion, like, should we first maybe have standards first and then implement something like carve-outs for AI red teaming, or would one actually allow for the other?
That's a great question. There's two things I want to react to in that. One is, when you mentioned the red teaming that happened in DEF CON last summer, you know, I just want to point out that this stuff is not really science fiction. This is happening now, right? People are red teaming AI, and what they were doing at DEF CON last year was not finding security vulnerabilities.
It was pumpkin
chair. That's right. They were circumventing or hacking guardrails in AI systems to try to make it do things like incorrect math. You know, or to say that one group of humans is inherently better than another group of humans, right? So this is already kind of a widespread activity that I think many of the larger AI model vendors, you know, are well aware of and view as important to their responsible deployment of AI. So this is happening now as an industry practice. That being said, we are kind of in an interesting space where, to your point, we don't really have standards for this yet. We are seeing methodologies. We are seeing companies start to put out papers. We're seeing academics put out papers about how they do this, you know, certain approaches that work better than others. And we are getting some really great learnings from that activity. But nothing that I would say is industry consensus. And one of the problems with that is that we are conflating a lot of our terms. So when we say red teaming, often that means like an adversarial style of testing where I'm pretending to be a hacker. You mentioned the executive order. It's a very important piece of this puzzle. The executive order defines AI red teaming as kind of a bundle of tests, a lot of different kinds of tests, and so not necessarily adversarial, and including both security and non-security. So one of the things that I think is really important will be to sort of disentangle what types of tests we're talking about and whether we're talking about security vulnerabilities or something else. And that non-security bucket doesn't really have a good name yet. Some people say vulnerability, but I think that's dangerous because we'll confuse it with security vulnerabilities. Now, to your question about standards, the executive order does require NIST to put out guidelines on a whole bunch of stuff. There's a ton of things that are going to come out of that executive order, but one of them that's happening very, very soon is NIST will put out guidelines on, among other things, AI red teaming. They accepted comments on it. Those comments were due earlier this month. So we're on the lookout for what those guidelines will do. My hope is that, among other things, they will help solve some of that terminology problems. It's a terminology problem that I mentioned earlier. It was sort of disentangle what types of tests, how to do it, and from there, I'm hopeful that we can move on to the discussion about, well, what are then the legal obligations for these different types of tests, and how can we protect companies that are trying to do the right thing, and individuals who are trying to do the right thing independently.
So in the trust and safety space, there was this movement for companies to sort of come together and work on the issue of combating CSAM and child sexual exploitation by sort of reporting to one centralized agency, NCMEC, and that model has sort of been reiterated with the GIFCT for dangerous organizations and combating terrorism and the use of, online platforms to really exploit dangerous organizations and dangerous individuals and to proliferate that content. Do you think for AI there could be a sort of similar coalition building among platforms that are creating generative AI models to sort of red team together? And what protection should exist if there were to be some sort of coalition of industry stakeholders that are trying to expose vulnerabilities by working together and seeing, how bad actors could potentially leverage those technologies?
So that's a great vision, and my answer is yes. I think that there is room for it, and I think that it would be helpful for the ecosystem. The model that I think would be most effective is not necessarily one where there's all reporting being funneled to a central location, but rather more on all lines of what we see in the cybersecurity space, where we have sector-based information security and analysis centers or information security analysis organizations, ISACs, ISOs. We have them as an outgrowth of the CISA 2015 law that I mentioned earlier. And within those organizations come those liability protections and the encouragement to share information with the other members so that they can get ahead of threats, attacks, and things like that, and keep their organizations, their technologies more secure, or in this case, more trustworthy. One of the things that I like about that is an explicit acknowledgement that the organizations that are doing this are doing it for the benefit of the ecosystem. They're able to work together, not necessarily with a federal entity or a regulator in the world. And they have these liability protections to encourage the free flow of discussion and ensure that the information that they share is not going to land them into trouble. There's this recognition that sharing that information will benefit everybody.
So it's lifting everybody's boats and maybe also is speedier than some of the regulatory or legislative solutions that exist.
Yes, although I think that while you could, I think under existing authorities, have an information sharing and analysis center for the AI sector, which is, in my opinion, not a bad idea. It'd be cross-cutting, obviously, but there are some unique concerns. One of the things that I'm raising with the legal protection gap is that you might need legislation or at least an additional executive order that provides that same protection for an information sharing and analysis organization related to non-security. Right? That law, since 2015, as I mentioned earlier, really provides those protections for security, not non-security. And it was, in 2015, it was at the time we were, we're behind the curve, but we were coming to realize that if cybersecurity is a joint problem for the world, I think we now have really absorbed that lesson just in time for AI to present a number of challenges related to non-security, like the possibility of misinformation, disinformation, and so forth. So I think we should tackle this in a similar way to security. I think it's been relatively successful in the security space. It's not without its problems, but I think it would be helpful in the non-security space as well.
Thank you.
question on a slightly unrelated note. I feel like in AI, with the different models sort of ranging from closed to very open, we end up developing like a like different kinds of standards depending on what the model is like. And then also on based on ownership between the model developer and then eventually like independent developers or sort of tinkering with it.
So I think that so number one, I don't want to get too technical because I'm conscious of your audience, and I'm also not an engineer. I'm a filthy lawyer. But we are already in regulation and standards starting to distinguish between types of model. And one of the ways that we're doing that is their size, their compute power, and also their placements for certain high-risk applications. So yes, I do see that happening. I think it's appropriate that it's happening. But I think we have a long way to go before, you know, we can really start to feature-proof that kind of distinction because the technology is moving so fast.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Harley.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. The Tech Policy Grind podcast was created by fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. It's co-produced by myself, Daniela Guzman Peña, and Evan Enzer, the editor and co-executive producer. Special thanks to Ajvaria, Harley, and Sasha for their collaboration and support in bringing this episode to air. I and other Foundry Fellows engage with the Foundry voluntarily and in our personal capacities. The views and opinions expressed on air do not reflect on the organizations we are affiliated with. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind podcast, and be sure to check out the Foundry on LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps out the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, reach out to us at foundrypodcasts@ilpfoundry.us, and you can find our email in the show notes. See you next time.